I'm going to try and pronounce it. Loviana. Is that right?
Sorry.
Okay. So he's got a PhD there, and then he went for a postdoc to Technion with Rosen.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had a postdoc with at CMU with Ira, we saw last week. And now he's a leave of absence. He's got a faculty job at Loviana, and he's got a leave of absence for his CERN. He's going to be telling us about some of the recent excitement in dark matter.
Okay, thanks, Mike. I'm really happy to be here. I really enjoyed this week. So right after I finish this talk, I have to rush out. So which means that if you have a question, you should ask immediately because we might run out of time. So what I'll be talking about is, as I said, about recent frenzy and the way you can picture that is that since the summer conferences, you see there's a lot of paper on particular topics. I'm not sure that I got all the papers here in the counting, but there's at least 43 papers so far. And luckily today you cannot. There's no update on Spire on archive. So
it's a big relief, actually.
because for the last 2 weeks, every day there will be at least a paper on this topic. And the strange thing is that, for instance, the Pamela data, which is the first paper on this topic that uses data, is at the end of October. So we have of the order of 20 papers, which are based solely on conferences slides with some preliminary data. So what I try to do is take a give you a snapshot of where we are now. And as this is a very lively field, there's lots of open questions. So let me start. The outline is the following. So first of all, I start with reviewing the data. What are the data telling us? Then I'll go through the challenges and some proposed solutions. I define all this, what the boost factor is, and why the navigation modes are a challenge. And then end up with the new challenges which appeared just a few days ago. With Pamela. So Pamela is a satellite mission which was launched in June 2006, more than 2 years ago. It's a collaboration of Italian, German, Swedish, and Russian physicists, astrophysicists. What the distinctive signature of this satellite mission is that you have your experiment has its you have a magnetic field, so you are able to distinguish between a positron and an electron, for instance. So you're able to distinguish between positive and negative charges. The expected sensitivity that is expected, so this is for 3 years of running. So their goal is to run for 3 years and possibly more. So after these 3 years, they should be able to measure the antiproton flux up to 190 GeV, the positron flux to 270 GeV, and so on. Right? There is also the anti-matter search, which sits in the title as well. So, they look for anti-matter, matter expression, like in astrophysics. So, what do they see? First, let me give you the spectrum in the positrons. So this is the Pamela data. This is the energy and the positron fraction. So it's a fraction of positron cosmic ray flux, which is the satellite, divided by the electron plus positron flux. So you see that it's relatively low energy. So you're at the level of 5%. Then it starts rising at about the energies of 10 GeV or so. The line over here is, so this is taken from their preprint. So the line here is the expected background, but what we should really think about design is that there is a large uncertainty, which is not given on this problem. Right. How large the uncertainty is, it's also a matter of debate. So, some people would say it's a larger uncertainty, other people would say it's a smaller uncertainty. The difference here is presumably due to a solar modulation. So when you're at lower energies, the fact how active you or where you sit in a solar cycle would affect the cosmic ray flux. Well, up here, it's a bit harder to explain this rise. We're found in a new source.
So you expect in the underground that it would go down like this? This is what, or the uncertainty is so large that you
okay, so the uncertainty is what, at most, it would get something which would level off maybe here. So when you sit at the high energies, it's very hard to explain that you have a rise.
What is the background mechanism, and is there a general argument as to why it's falling?
The way this thing works is you have a diffusion equation, you put in a source, and then it diffuses away, and it also, you're losing energy, so you would depopulate the lower energetic beams. So you have a positron source and an electron source, they would lose energy, means that repopulate this lower level. And I also
this background, I think, is just from pure second
Objection
of positrons as such, at least it's accelerated electrons giving on other
stars.
How sure are they that they're not misidentifying problems?
Oh, that was so. Marco gave a talk at CERN about that. So,
Marco,
So they did the beam test at CERN. And what I think what they have is the following. They, up to 100 GeV, they did not misidentify any of the protons which hit their detector, and they had 100,000 protons at that energy. So that's the statistics. The problem is, of course, that the proton spectrum is, I mean, you have much more protons than the positron. So. He did not give a number when he got to 100 GeV, but presumably it's very small, this 100 GeV. Plus, on top of that, they make they do other tests, so they, irrespective of this test at CERN, so they would look at how they shower, and they would take out the first layers of the colorimeter, and look. How the showering person, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't explain that much. But there's two tests that they do at the end of the day. So they seem to be quite confident that they're not misidentifying things. Of course, you never know if there is some systematic that you can think about.
Why would there be such a difference in the antiproton and the positron fractions? If they're coming from the same part.
Oh, it's a different source. The proton and the positron electron spectrum should be connected because you have the secondary production, but I don't think that's true for protons.
So what's the source of the antiproton?
Tell you that I'm new to this field, so I try to learn as much as possible from this.
There are cosmic rays, with protons, and then same sources, solar, ions, and so on, very energetic, protons giving on nuclei, there's a certain probability of producing that protons.
Does that mean that the uncertainties are, they don't know where the cosmic rays are coming from in the first place, and then you also don't know the distribution?
Oh, but there is a, what you do is you, you have different spectra for the light nuclei and the protons. You want to explain them using the same inputs, right? So you fix your model from as a light nuclei, and then you predict this thing. And you see that the degree is marvelous.
Yeah, whereas the previous slide was one of the worst fits I've ever seen in my life, right?
Right, so right. Because it seems that it's much harder. I also know that it's much harder to predict photon spectrum as well.
I believe you what with protons you measure the spectrum there. Like with electrons and positrons, they lose energy so quickly that you kind of don't know exactly.
So certainly the backgrounds are here to think question.
If you have a width X naught anti-core, then it looks like a normal positron electron magnetization. You've got this problem. So maybe it's something at all experimental. You see what I'm saying?
You're trying to say there are no model building ways of fixing this?
There's
lots of models, very natural models that can have leptonic injection. You can have models that have both, and you can have models that inject on the leptons.
Yeah. So we can argue maybe after 10 slides. So the other experiment.
We're not trying to argue. I'm just trying to understand.
Sure, but I hope it will be clear. So that's a balloon experiment. They fly it over Antarctica, and it's only a calorimeter that they send us. So they cannot distinguish charges, the positive and the negative charge for them is the same thing, but they are able to measure, for instance, whether it's they're able to distinguish, let's say, electron from a proton or light. The payoff is that they can load much higher energy. So this I took from their website. It's very optimistic. I don't know at which time scale they're able to go about. They don't distinguish the electrons and positrons. So what they see is the following. So this is the red dots are the data from Arctic. So this was disappeared in Nature last Friday. And the other ones are the younger experiments. And it's hard to follow, but I see that there's something going on over here. Well, this is the expected background. Again, with some error thing. And while this would be a solar modulation, so the of solar modulation, which kicks in, as we saw before, at below 10 GeV or something. And is irrelevant at higher energies.
So why does this agree so much better than the other one does? The solar modulation thing is that's giving anywhere between the dotted line and the solid line? Is that the...
Well, they... I think they take some parameter, fix it for the solar modulation. It's in terms of rigidity. I don't know whether it's reasonable or not, but I guess, yeah, somewhere in between.
It's also not the same quantity as quantity, right?
This is
the same, and in previous case it was a ratio.
But that's something that we don't do that job.
Yeah, I also think that the electron spectrum is also quite uncertain. Okay, so the question is, do we see a cutoff? Why is it interesting whether we see a cutoff? Is that, let's say, if you have a dark matter annihilating, and two dark matter particles annihilating, it's that there's a natural cutoff of the dark matter mass. There is not going to be any exits above that mass. So if we, so let me do something very simple and probably even too naive, but let's say if we take these backgrounds to be given, so it's something that we can trust, and try to fit the Gaussian to it. So we take the asymmetric Gaussian, there's the above the mean value, there is another sigma, and below that mean value, we also vary the sigma. You see that the best fit, you see it here, so this is the mean, and the value of upper sigma. So if the upper sigma is at zero, it means that it's a sharp product. So the best fit is this thing, you're sitting at 550 GeV, the lower sigma is 220 GeV, the upper sigma is 120 GeV, and the chi-square is 20.2. If you impose a hard cutoff, the chi-square goes to 20.4. It's almost indistinguishable. Yeah. And that's probably here. This is the 90% confidence level about region. Then if you, let's say, if you vary the upper seat, if you make it a very broad feature, the chi-square would go up to by 4 points. So it seems like you are seeing some cutoff, but it's not completely statistically fixed.
Sorry, so very basic. So if you see in post a hard cutoff, so what you're since your actual CPR now, mm-hmm. So what do you mean? So from the picture that you draw, see your hard cutoff there, so why there's still since an actual so beyond cutoff so value of
above the cutoff?
Yes.
Oh, but the cutoff is in the feet. So you want the feet, so this is the cutoff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you fall back onto the background.
Right. Okay. You do have some actual in the flux.
So that's the offending
error. So that's the
point, right? That's the, yeah, this one is everything else. It's consistent with what's in the
flux.
You see that the difference between that line and that line is only 0.2, so it's completely
what is PF?
What's the
number?
Oh, sorry. So the number is made is mean, the lower sigma, the upper sigma. Okay, so the interpretations. So it seems like we do have an extra source. There is a bound for our cutoff. So there are two interpretations that are on the market. One is that it's due to astrophysical sources, pulsars, or it's a signal of dark matter, non-gravitational dark matter interaction. So if we show one slide on the astrophysical source, so this that you would see and some features in E plus E minus spectrum from a local pulsar was discussed many years, has been known for quite many years, but in connection with the Mandela and Arctic data, it's for the people to try to see whether it fits. So the upshot is that if you do, it roughly does give you the right features. What you would need is a pulsar which is relatively young, but not too young. There's a sweet spot where it's large enough that you have an escape of positrons, so that the nebula is not too dense. But it should not be too old because you want to have energetic enough positrons. So this is taken from Arctic publication. What they do here is they plot the reduced spectra or modeled spectra from four different pulsars. And that's the data, right?
Okay.
So what you can try to do is, first of all, you see that none of them really fits, but let's say if you multiply this by a given factor, which they tend to be 30, you still see that the spectrum is not really.
What is the dashed line?
The dashed line is now the sum of this line plus the background. So the background comes from this cardboard. You see that if you want to fit the bump here, you end up with too many low energy electrons, positrons. Whether it's a dark matter signal, let's see if, let's say we assume that it's due to the dark matter annihilating, so we have two dark matter particles going to final state, which can be either, let's say, E plus E minus, V plus V minus, tau plus tau minus, the QQ bar, or the BB bar tops, WZZ, HH, I mean, like any of those. And then what the Cherry and company did is they performed the modeling dependent analysis. And they find two preferred solutions. One is that you have one TeV, dark matter, particles which decays mostly to leptons, which annihilates into leptons, or you have a very heavy dark matter which annihilates into WW.
I have an issue when people call it model independent than others, right? Yeah. Because I already have a model on the internet where the leading signature is four leptons in the final state and nothing else. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually wasn't model independent. You still assume something, right?
And I think, okay, since you brought it up, I think as far as I was able to follow that paper, they also, I mean, there is a nice idea that if you assume that it's a two-body final state, you don't need to really distinguish between the scalar and the fermion initial state, because what it matters is that it's a scalar, it's a bosonic, and these two guys give you a bosonic initial state. Right? Then you count, and then you have choices for the spinning, 0, 1, 2, right? If these guys are scalars, fermions, or vectors. As far as I was able to tell, they did not do the spin 2 case. Okay, so I think they do only the spin 0 and spin.
But they could be a lot like
so that
it's discussed now, and with the metastable particles that fully decay, right?
That's
completely
not included at all.
This is probably just explain my ignorance. But if I calculate the amplitude for this process using Feynman graphs, then I'll get a coupling constant squared. Mm-hmm. And so then I can convert this into a Compton scattering, exchanging one of these guys between two points. We know from a large number of underground experiments the cross section for winds from guys interacting with the Hawkes nuclei is extremely small. In fact, it's zero, so to speak, because they've never seen it.
Yeah, so
that puts that fixes a value of G by coupling constant. So putting back that in, I know that the number of events is equal to cross section times the velocity. So I can calculate the velocity.
Right, so the direct detection is certainly a problem.
Here that doesn't match.
If, I mean, in principle, but first of all, if you only couple to the leptons, there is no problem.
What?
If you only couple to the leptons, there is no problem.
Well, what about the core, anti-core?
What you're seeing the signal only in the leptons, right?
Even if you couple to the Higgs, there is no problem because the Higgs couple to nuclei. So there is no generality. You cannot say.
So it's a model
scattering, therefore there is no annihilation. It's just not that.
So you're saying that.
Moreover, I can construct a model that has exactly zero in the scattering, right? I mean, so it's very, very small and then still a sizable annihilation.
If you continue with the experiment, Zeppelin, for example. And we still don't
you
see
You would not be able to rule
the
out.
The same as zero.
I wish to.
Let's say
you can't rule out the name. The
you cannot rule out Wim's period, okay? You can have the best experiment in the lowest Newton background. There will be, you know, the model parameter space is nearly infinite.
But this is not good.
I agree.
It's reality.
Okay, so let me show you a few slides from their paper on what you would get for dark matter of different masses. So if you take the 150 GeV dark matter, this is the Palmetto delta. That's the assumed background, and this is the signal path background, and this line over here is the signal. So this is going into WWW. Right? Then you have a small bump at lower energies for E plus E minus. You don't expand this bump at all. And then you have a big problem in the antiproton space. Right? You're producing way too many quarks from the W. So let's say 1 TeV dark matter, which decays to mu plus mu minus. That's the Palmetto signal. Okay. You will eventually you see this cutoff, right, because of the dark matter mass. You have a bump here in the E plus and minus, and you see almost nothing about the background for the
So what they're doing is just varying the couplings kind of? I mean that second scenario to turn off.
Oh this they fit, right? It's a fit to the data.
Okay. So choosing the couplings.
You choose the coupling of the particular operator which sits in the when it's an EFT effective field theory preparation. You fit one coupling and then you predict the rest. So 10 TeV, no problem here. You don't explain the bump at 1 TeV. And then you're fine in the proton spectrum.
What about multiple couplings from two different operators that they consider?
What they do is they here they only look at one particular final state and then the other one and so on. So if you mix, they switch off all the other couplings and just switch on one of them. So the challenges, as maybe we already said, were the signal is only in the leptons, but not in the quarks, right? You don't see anything in the antiproton spectrum. And the other one is that the annihilation cross-section is larger than expected for a thermal relic. So I'll spend a few more slides on this other problem. So thermal relic, I will start to review a bit the dark matter or the relic density calculations basics. So to observe, we observe some
library surface intersection. In the previous case, they like the best, you know, the just right Goldilocks model was a TeV decaying to E plus to minus.
Mm-hmm.
Would it have been equally good to decay into E plus to minus?
Yeah.
Case, so it's you don't want something which is giving you hypothesis or something else.
Right, so tau E plus to minus, U plus V minus are almost equally good. Cool. It's really. You cannot statistically distinguish between those. So if you have a simple one component dark matter, the measured dark matter density in the universe or relic abundance will fix you the annihilation cross section at the freeze-out. That's the magic number. So how that happens is that you have this dark matter particle coupled to the visible sector, the standard model. The temperature of the universe cools down. You get the Boltzmann suppression in the number density of the dark matter particles. So the dark matter particles are getting rarer and rarer. There's less chance of them annihilating, so at some point they just freeze out. They're so rare that they don't annihilate until the standard model. So when that happens, is so that's what's about. And why is the number density normalized to the entropy density? And there's the individual which is also X, which is the mass of the dark matter divided by the temperature. So temperature goes down, you move in that direction. So that means that it freezes out, no longer follows the Boltzmann distribution. And when it will freeze out depends on the annihilation cross section. The larger the annihilation cross section, the longer it can still annihilate, right? It becomes less and less dense. The larger the annihilation cross section, the longer it can still annihilate. So, smaller annihilation cross section means larger relic abundance. That's why there's an inverse proportion to the relic abundance. Okay, so now let me introduce this boost factor. So what Fermilla and Ettig measure are annihilation cross section into B plus and minus. Now, right? What the relic abundance fixes for you is the annihilation cross section multiplied by velocity at the freeze out. That's the sum. So first of all, what can change is the annihilation cross section between the freeze out and now. And it's also proportional, the flux is also proportional to the number density of dark matter particles in the halo. So number density squared, that's what gives you the flux. So the boost factor, which I introduce, is the expected positron flux would be for a simple thermal relic, which is S-wave annihilation, this thing will be constant in the time evolution. Okay. Why this thing is constant, it's easy to see. There's 1 over V in the formula for the cross section. And if you have an S-wave annihilation, there's no V dependence in the amplitude square. You take the expected dark matter density. So this will be the normalization factor, what you expect. And what you measure is this thing here. So that's the boost factor. Maybe not everybody would call this exactly the boost factor, but that's what I call it. So just some definition. So once again, the boost factor is a mismatch between the observed flux and expected flux if it was a simple thermal relic.
So if you know, you can estimate well dark matter in order to fit the panel of data.
Right.
Then you have to.
Okay, so that's in the next slide. So the boost factor that you need, so that's again from this Cherry paper, is you take different finer states, you see that the boost factors for different dark matter masses would be roughly scale as one as a mass squared, right? Because the scale is number squared. So you would go up from, let's say, a factor of 10 up to 10 to the so 1,000 to 10 TeV, 1 TeV, and 1,001 TeV. And there's a slightly different slope. So the way you can, so that's what you were aiming at is that the mismatch between the observed and expected can be either in the cross section or in the fact that the dark matter density is not the one that you would expect. So the astrophysical boost factor, so if you have some dark matter halo substructure, that can be at most a factor of 10 or so. Okay. So that means that
so the point is that you, once you know a row, fits and the data, we know what density of dark matter you expect in halos and galaxies for W matter. It's a factor of 6 to get the rotation curves. So you have to be able to connect the two. There are bounds in these things astrophysically.
So you take the dark matter density in our halo, our galaxy. You use the n-body simulations, you see how much the what you can expect, And people would usually set a factor of 3, but not more than 10.
It's important, it's a local density.
It's a local density close by. Maybe I didn't stress that enough, because the positrons can at most come from, they will originate from local areas, so 500 parsecs or so, or less.
So it fits.
So that's why you needed the local parser as well, it's for the same reason.
So it fits the astrophysical data.
There is a mismatch, you cannot do it with the astrophysical data. If I see that one TV, there is a mismatch of orders.
Where does this first come from?
Yeah, exactly. Before I go on, there's another point, is that the boost factor cannot be arbitrarily large. There's a utility bound on the annihilation cross-section, which goes like this. So if that can easily translate into a boost factor. So I divide the magic number, the expected annihilation cross-section. That's what you're getting.
Right. That's of course assuming it's S wave.
Oh,
annihilation,
S.
Right? Is that, you know?
Yeah. So
good engineers,
the non-trivial
reference.
Yes. We have the slides which follow. it's assuming this thing. But you get, I think it's an interesting bound. You get the mass of the guy cannot be arbitrarily high, so it's even at 10 TV, which is something that people are considering. It's not, okay, so where do these large boost factor come from? The proposed, or the ideas that are out there are, there's a Sommerfeld enhancement. So you introduce some new long range objective interaction, and that will enhance the annihilation cross section. We have annihilation through resonances, so that's maximum. They also put an idea of
can I just make a small correction? It's called rats, it's grids. Yeah, there are both, you know, there are scientists who both. In the names,
it can be a non-thermal dark matter, so that's my excuse for giving this talk. A decaying dark matter, or different temperature in the dark matter sector and the visible sector. So I tried to go through all of this, but I have to be quite sketchy, unfortunately. So the Sommerfeld enhancement is maybe not too difficult to understand. So if you have, it will only kick in when you have non-relativistic dark matter particles. So why it will kick in when they're non-relativistic is that if you can imagine that you have an attractive force, it will create a potential warp. If they are slowly moving, they will fall into that well. So that will increase the probability that they annihilate. So what you can do is now come to the details, right? So how you really do that is you would introduce a new particle, an interaction carrier. So then you have this ladder diagram that will give you that will sum up and give you, for instance, a Yukawa potential. This thing is a mess. It annihilates into something. So quite a popular choice is that you are so-called secluded models, where you use the same force carrier to also shield you from the standard model. So only this phi field will couple to the standard model. So you have the dark matter particle, which is the heavy guy. You have the light particle, which gives you an attractive interaction. Plus, for instance, if you have annihilation into the light guy, and that then decays into the standard model. That way you complete and you shield yourself from the standard model. But it's not necessary to do that, right? I mean, you could imagine that you only have this attractive interaction, and then your dark matter directly
carbon primarily center of the spark
model. You are allowed to have a coupling. So you are allowed to have that kind of coupling, the spinel model.
Right, so then you have to worry about the bounds more.
But the, we know the Indian aspect, for instance, annihilation cross section is suppressed, PF suppressed. So then I don't understand why you're talking about the absence of the dark matter coupling.
Why?
It's not.
Okay, so. So there's two problems which are here. One is that you have to enhance the cross section. The other one is that you have to also expand it in the case to the left. So why this is popular is that you can kinematically suppress the decay into anything else. So this thing is light enough to not decay into proton or other problems. But you have to, then you don't have to do any engineering to.
The plane decays and the hot decay, most decay modes are suppressed. And still, you could have coupling.
Yes, you could have coupling.
So what? So what happens when you now have dark matter interactions between dark matter
particles? What happens? You get an enhanced relationship.
So what happens when you apply this to apply simulations of galaxies? People try this. Once you start it's about a dark matter interact, you could get into problems. You can ask your number fixed.
You're saying that it all also what you're saying is it also affects the
It affects the end-by simulations.
So there are several leaps that you may consider, but I may not be able to report for all of them. Is that, just let me give you the upshot. The upshot is that for these secluded models, if you really want to work out the kinematics, you will have to sit on a resonance to get a large enough perspective. So if you, that's the option. You have to sit on a resonance, so it looks a bit more artificial. So let me move to my idea.
So what's the mass of the fire? So what's the mass of the fire particle you need?
Okay, so that again, that's if you want to. So in order to sit here, so there's two regimes basically. If you want, without any, if you're not sitting on the threshold resonance, there are basically two regimes. Either you're fast enough that you don't see the incubo, but you only see the 1 over r potential, then you're this regime, which means that if you want to, that would mean that the fire should have below the energy. The other regime is that you're slow enough that you see the incubo, then you have a saturation in how large the boost factor can be. So that's the saturation. Then here you're above 30 MeV. Okay. And usually people would take 1 GeV or so. Just plug in the numbers, you see that the boost factor is not large enough. It's not ideal
in the case. In case where the fire has a mass, so less than 63 MeV, why do you say, some missing energy in some secondary physics?
Okay, so. This guy can couple very weakly to the standard model. Right? It only has to decay into the standard models. So the other option is that, for instance, if you have a metastate, so let me consider this option that I have two components in dark matter. One is metastable, decays after the freeze out, so it decays into the dark matter that is present now. In that way, what you do is you no longer have this fixed relation between the narration, cross section, and the freeze out, and the editing.
The freeze out
of the first one.
The first one that you start doesn't even have to be a wheel, right? It could be
something
that repopulate and you repopulate. Yeah. So you all what you care about is just repopulating.
We see what you need, right? You don't need you need some meta stable state. You will see what the bounds are on what you need, right? There are two things that you need is, first of all, you need a freeze out. So first assumption is that you are in thermal equilibrium with your internal contact with the standard model. Then you freeze out and it decays into the dark matter.
You need an assumption for this for more strongly interacting components, and it will be in thermal equilibrium and so on. But the things that you use for populating your limbs, it can be in the thermal contact or may not be in the thermal contact.
Yeah, but so the bonds
will be slightly different physics.
Yeah.
So to summarize, you find that the dark matter and radiation amplitude is off by order of magnitude. By the way, that's the amount that astrophysics is off by to fit that one. So you fix it with this boost. Is that right?
By three orders.
Three orders.
Right.
14. Sorry, no, by three orders.
But that's a long way up. I mean,
if you take the simplest model, you will be over fired by three orders of magnitude.
So you have to. You have to fiddle with nature to get
maybe it's a more positive aspect. You can say that it's telling us something about the nature of dark matter.
It's what?
It's telling us something about the nature of dark matter. You can either say, I don't know what's going on. I mean, there are hints, right? If this is dark matter, you know much more than it is before. Yes, you have to.
Maybe you know more than you took before. Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
Maybe not. So the thing that governs the boost factor at the end, or what the relative density is this ratio between the masses of the dark matter and this decaying particle. It's the ratio of the masses times the annihilation cross section divided by mass
and the annihilation cross section of the decaying
dark. So, in order to have a large and enhanced relative density of the dark matter, what you would need is a much smaller annihilation cross section for the decaying dark. So, if I have a boost factor of 10 to 3, I need to make this ratio also 10 to 3. So I have a hard key. So this is the boost factor, 10 to the n something. So if you want to have a boost factor of 1,000, that version has to be almost 1,000 as well. The other important thing is also that you have to decay long enough after the freeze out so that you don't have a washout effect. It has to decay long after the freeze out that you and that will give you the following bound on the decay. So this is a non-trivial bound. You also have an upper bound, a lower bound of the decay time. And from nuclear synthesis, that would be the upper bound. So a simple possibility would be, let's say, you take z times and z times prime, you go through the exercise, and you only break the z time z2 prime by some dimension 5 operator. So the only thing I want to show here is that the scale at which that thing has to be C2 prime has to be broken in order to have to avoid, to have to sit in the right, to avoid the decay time constraint, so that it decays after the freeze out. Okay, that's the bound. So the scale has to be larger than 10 to the 10 GU. Okay, that's a paper which I also found quite interesting. Is that that's a version of a secluded model where you try to increase the temperature in the hidden sector. So what they do is the following: is that they have so that's the secluded model. The dark, this is the dark matter. This is the signal of Fermilab, right? It decays into these light guys, and then they decay into the standard model. The way you increase the temperature in the hidden sector in the early universe is you consider the following thermal history. So first, the hidden and the visible sector decouple. Then you have lots of other matter in the hidden sector which annihilate into the dark matter that will raise your temperature. Then the phi recovers from chi1 and phi decays. But the nice thing about the whole story is that even if they raise this thing, if they push this thing to infinity, right, the hidden temperature, they still get an upper bound on the boost vector, which I found quite remarkable. And it's quite small. So that means that this is not the way to enhance the boost vector. Okay, so it's not really, you need a factor of 1,000, right? But we're not doing. Decaying dark matter. It's also an interesting possibility is that you assume that the dark matter is metastable on cosmological time scales. So what you would typically need to fit the Fermilab and ATIC signal is the decay times of about 10 to the 26 seconds. We translate into a decay width of 10 to the minus 51 GeV. Okay, so let's see what that means really. So let's see if this decay is coming from some dimension 5 or dimension 6 operator. The scale at which connected sitting in front of the operator is 1 over lambda, if you want, the scale at which some Z2 symmetry is broken is for dimension 5 operator is 10 to the 29 GeV. So what that tells you is that you have to have some other small coefficient in front. Now you can try to find small coefficients that are there already or invent new ones. But if you have a dimension 6 operator, you see that it's a god scale. Interesting here. I already said quite a lot about this phonic mode channel. So maybe I'll just repeat it. One way is to kinematically suppress the decays into antiprotons. So what you do is you have these intermediate light guys, which are light enough that they don't decay into protons. The other option is that you just engineer your model such that it only couples to them. So now, in the last minute or so, here are the challenges of the last week. The new data from HES appeared on Monday or so on E plus E minus flux above 1 TeV.
Why did you say last week? This week?
This week, on Monday, yeah. Yeah. Of the past week, maybe I should say, past. And two papers out also which compare the observed photon flux from galactic center, galactic ridge, or the dwarf spiral galaxies. This is the first one, so HES data. What they observe is that after a TeV or so, 2 TeV, you have a change. if that's how they interpret this, is that you have a change in the power of. You should be careful, the whole the whole thing is multiplied by e to the 3. So you have a power law here, which goes to e to the 3, made that way, times flat. And then you see that there's a change in the power law.
I need an anti push.
We'll see. I have another slide, which
is Pamela here?
Is Pamela? Oh, Pamela is now this is E plus E minus. Okay, so this S is a Cherenkov, a series of four Cherenkov detectors we looked up in the atmosphere, and they reduce the E plus E minus flux. So Pamela is only positron fraction. So what you have here is Arctic, which are these stars, and that's these points over here.
So Attic is also is just electron, is that
electron plus positron.
And Attic is also like a
and then this is the Hertz, the new
version. What is the meaning of the change of contact with the
of what?
What is the meaning of the change?
That's a good question. No, is there a change in the power law on that? I would say it's not clear to me. Because let's say if we take let's say you take the data of Attic and Hess, and you do the following. You just take the change in the power law, so I take a kink in the power law, that's the black line. You do the fit, the chi-square is 49 and 25 degrees of freedom. If you do something else, let's say we mock up some source, so we can eat some power law times exponential.
25 degrees of freedom mostly coming from my
So this is 29 points minus 4 that you need to fix the power law here, the power law here, the overall normalization, and
where they join.
Oh, yes. And or if you do you do a power law with a king and a source, you see that it's still there. The bump is still there. So you cannot just explain it with a power law.
So there are only four points to give the point. What's the signaling there?
Well, you can see the change in the sigma, if you do this source plus the kink, the change in sigma is 10. Because it's more than only this point.
Yeah. I wouldn't bet my final.
Here's the question. So the bump just happens before the king. So there should be a power some relation, right?
It is uncomfortable, yes.
Okay.
I mean, what I don't remember right now is if you try to fit without the king. And then there's two other papers. One is looking at the dark matter in relation to the photon sigma, and it seems that different bounds. Some is from the blue ones are from different regions in the galaxy, so the central region, the galactic reach is this thing. This is dependence on dark matter mass versus the cross section. This is the preferred region by Pamela and Patrick. And these are the exclusion excluded regions. And you see that for most profiles, dark matter profiles, except for the isothermal profile, you're more or less excluded. Whether you can trust the profiles, that's a different matter. The problem is that it comes from the region which is close to the galactic center, which is more uncertain. That's where the most constraints come. While if you take the decay dark matter, the solids are not so secure, and that's easy to understand because the for the decay, what you are sensitive is the dark matter density itself, while for the annihilation is dark matter density squared. So if you have a spike in the center, it will be much more pronounced in the annihilation. It's a very active field. The question is, are we seeing a dark matter signal or something else? I don't know, but many people signed on the on interpreting it as a dark matter signal because it is an exciting possibility whether it will turn out or not. That's a different question. There's going to be more data coming, so hopefully we'll know more. And I presented this two-component dark matter model that can explain the large perspective.
He really has to catch a plane, so if there's any quick questions.
Okay. So we're saying there's a change in the power load. So that's as it happens at that happens at every scale. Say above orbital the cutoff scale. I mean that the first thing. So that you say first inferred from Sikanda or Sahi.
Well, it happens quite close, right? The cutoff scale used, it's about 700 GeV, and this thing turns over at, let's say, 2 PeV, so I don't know what to make out of it.
But I mean, 2 PeV is higher than 700.
It is, yeah.
So since there's a pump, and right after that, there is a spray, but then one natural scenario to think of is that there is some mechanism that cools down electron positrons from high energies to low energies, which pile them up basically just below the king.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something like that suggested?
No, no. But that would be very interesting because people, I mean, if you look at these plots, I haven't seen a plot where you would really get the whole bump. Usually what you're having is something like this. I mean, you see that the whole bump is very pronounced.
So there's a paper cup there.
By your computer, this chart.
Oh. Okay, so it looks like that, right? So this very pronounced parts, and usually you have the bump which is not so high. Okay. So you're missing here. So I don't see the paper if you really be able to have a large bump. Yes. So that would be certainly a very preferred explanation because you would have this pile up and it really looks like a
is there any possibility that there's some experimental problem with anything?
Well, there's a lot of experiments which have this hint of a bump over there, right? All the experiments are very consistent. You see the bump, but the errors are larger.
The thing is, I was thinking a problem is addict, right? Is it just that if you don't really allocate
it, no, you still have PP beds, which have a bit larger errors, but they're right on top of active, and then you have another one of heat, which if you relax the normalization, it will come exactly to active, but it lies a bit below, but it's still in the past. So if you believe that there's a 4% least normalization of the data.
So there should be more data coming. Is it more from the same experiments, or are there new measurements you're coming out?
Well, there's a claim that Hess will be able to measure precisely this lower region as well, but they haven't really tested it.
If I take the lower energy range of Panama data, it has some, it doesn't look quite in agreement with heat and etc. Is it possible to explain by solar population? Because in your plot, you didn't put heat and then it's on.
Yeah, I didn't.
Oh, exactly.
Very nice.
Signal, right?
Yeah, okay, that's what you're referring to.
Right.
Is that there is a mismatch between previous measurements and primarily the low region. And the question is whether that can be explained by a solar modulation or not. Yeah.
Wait. We know from Moshe.
I mean, their claim is, of course, that they can explain it, and they do also see some modulation inter-territorial. There is some time dependence. They see.
So the Roger and the question raised, this JK said,
yeah,
controversy for like 7 years. Right. There's a systematic error in the data.
Right, that's true.
And you have to be careful.
Yeah, that's why I said that the normalization, you can play with the normalization, you will still see the bug.
I think we need to learn those.